I am Planta on the Line in Vancouver at thecommentary.ca. Angela Crocker joins me again. She's got a new book out, Declutter Your Data, Take Charge of Your Data, and Organize Your Digital Life. It's a book one needs, as we're all accumulating stuff, and often stuff we can't see just how much of it we have on our phones, laptops, desktop computers, if you still have one, tablets, and in the cloud. I'll get Ms. Crocker to tell us about where to start, what we need to keep, and what we don't. Angela Crocker has been described as a pioneer of ethical social media and has been known for her organizing savvy. She's an author, speaker, and instructor, helping businesses and individuals with their planning, communication, and digital media engagement. This is her fourth book, and it's published by Self Counsel Press. Visit angelacrocker.com for more. Please welcome back to the Planta Online program, Angela Crocker. Ms. Crocker, good morning.
Good morning, and hello.
Nice to talk again.
I'm so glad to talk to you again.
Yeah, I just realized that it's been less than a year since we last talked, because you had another book out a year or so ago.
I did. The Content Planner came out almost exactly a year before Declutter Your Data. It's been a bit of a whirlwind to have two books in 2 years.
Yeah, I mean, I can see how you do it, because, you know, I've read your books, obviously, and I can see how you tell your readers how to get organized. But, I mean, is it difficult for you to, because, I mean, this book, Declutter Your Data, has, you know, charts and things to how to organize yourself and grade yourself as well, whether you're able to keep track. How are you in terms of keeping yourself on the task?
I like to think that's one of my strongest skills. I've actually had somebody call me a superhero of organization a while back, and I kind of like the idea that I'm wearing an invisible cape. I just naturally seem to see patterns in information and projects and timelines, and I'm not sure that everyone is blessed with that skill, but I like to play to my strengths, of course. And Declutter Your Data, to be truthful, is a book that's been in my head for a couple of years. I started talking about what I was originally calling a digital cleanse process back in 2016. And it just resonated with so many people. And as I was talking about it with my publisher at Self Counsel Press, they said, well, is it a book? I said, yeah, it could be. And so within a few months, here we are with the book version, which is much richer than anything I've been able to share in a lecture at college or a talk at a conference like Social Media Camp or even in a series of blog posts. So I'm really proud of this one.
Now, as someone who manages their time well, who I would assume lives to some sort of schedule and you know, who has their days planned out pretty much, one would think that that doesn't leave much time for spontaneity. I mean, does it?
Well, the way I write, it does. Somebody recently gave me the phrase binge writer, which I think really applies to me. I'm not rigorous about writing 2 hours every morning or, you know, every Sunday is set aside for writing or someday.
Yeah.
What I tend to do is gather information, you know, be reading and researching and making piles of notes, both in paper. I have stacks of books from the research for this project, and also on my computer. And then when I feel like I've reached a point where some pieces of it are going to come together, I will sit down and just a few days or maybe a few weeks, depending on the length, put together the words that you start to see in the books. And I write in a conversational style, so I'm always imagining I'm chatting with someone about the topic.
Yeah, it's very engaging at that, and well, all your books are.
Thank you.
But this one in particular I found very useful. When your publicist Rachel Wood said that you had a new book out, and if I wanted to talk to you, I said, of course. And she said, well, do you want me to send you an electronic copy of the book or the actual tactile version? I said, you know, I've always railed against e-books, but, you know, I must admit I've started reading them on my devices and the sort. But I said, no, I'd like a real copy, if you will, because I'm liable to lose it if it's in the e-form.
And I think your experience there is very common.
Yeah, and I just realized at that point this is a book I need, because I've got a lot of stuff on all my devices, whether it's my phone, my tablet, my laptop, my desktop, that, you know, I'm the perfect person for your book, because I think we all have a lot of clutter on our, you know, on our devices, right?
I think one of the real things that's eye-opening as people are hearing about the idea of decluttering your data is that it's so hidden. Inside each mobile phone, there can be gigabytes of data. Inside a computer, you might not even have any memory in the computer, but it's all stored in the cloud on Google Drive or Dropbox or iCloud, something like that. And it's a universal condition if we're using technology to communicate, to do business, to create, whether we're writing or photography or anything. I quote research in the book that talks about the averages, and this was research from September 2017, and I'm sure it still holds true, that every household in America has 41.5 terabytes of data across 14 devices. It's a huge amount of information, and yet it can be in a little compact, you know, 2 or 3 or the 14 devices. It can compactly be tucked in a desk drawer or in a bag and largely out of sight. It's not like the clutter in your kitchen where you are frustrated every time you try and open the serving utensil drawer and it all crashes out at you. So part of what I'm trying to do with the book is really advocate for the amount of digital that we're including in our lives and hopefully shifting people's thinking to being more about how do they want to use technology rather than feeling obligated to use technology.
Right, right. And we'll get to that in just a sec. But, I mean, on my phone, you know how people are if you're out and about and you're looking for a restaurant or you're looking for a store. And so you go to their website and you want to get, say, whatever it is, their price list or their menu. And so you type it into your phone, and then, you know, rather than a web page coming up, it automatically downloads as PDF. You look at it, and then it's there forever. I mean, I hazard to think the sort of PDFs that are on one's phone. My previous phone, because I just got a new phone, there must be hundreds in there that I've never looked at more than once. And, I mean, that's the sort of clutter we're talking about, right?
In part, that's the sort of clutter we're talking about. It is things that we create, so emails and photographs and documents that we create. It's also the information that we inadvertently gather along the way, as you're talking about, the PDF that automatically downloads to give you the restaurant menu, which you want to read in the moment, but you don't need long term. And then there's other elements of what I'm calling a digital footprint. Collectively, all of these things are a digital footprint. And it's things like our decisions to create accounts when we're shopping. If you're online shopping, you almost inevitably have to create an account. Pretty much any retailer you go to now, when you step to the counter to pay, it's the person behind the cash desk. Can we have your email? Would you like to join our list?
Yeah.
Would you like to join our loyalty program? And all of those decisions in everything that we do are creating this increasingly sized digital footprint. And I'm all for people using digital tools and digital lifestyle decisions that give them the information they want. If you love that retailer and you want their coupons, by all means, sign up.
Mm-hmm.
But if you're visiting a city and it's a brand you'll never visit again, why clutter your inbox with that information when you're never going to go back? You're not going to be a loyal customer. Just as much as you don't want the clutter, I'm sure the retailer strategically doesn't want to invest money in maintaining that database information.
And your book talks about the pitfalls of that in terms of the implications to privacy.
Yes. Yes, we all are creating this often easily searchable set of information about us. I have a colleague at the Digital Hallway, Sean Smith, who does work with teenagers and high schools around how social media teens are using it and how they're creating a digital footprint without even understanding it. And part of the work he does in advance the preparation is talking about or looking at what those students have online. And then he walks into the room as though he knows them.
Mm-hmm.
It's a marvelous thing, because they get really freaked out when they find out that their Snapchat photos or their Twitter tweets or whatever have provided enough information to a complete stranger, a man they don't know, to be able to call them by name and ask them about their weekend and their hobbies and so on. There's so much, Google anyone. And then there's the flip side to that, too, that's distinguishing. I know for certain there are at least 21 other Angela Crockers on the planet.
Uh-huh.
some of them are very laudable individuals. They are accomplished lawyers and accomplished athletes. I'm happy to be in good company with them. But there is also at least one who is frequently in trouble with the law. That's
and
not me.
And that's not you, right? Yeah, okay, good.
No.
Yeah, it's a perilous cycle because it comes at us quite quickly as well, and we lose sight of it obviously until something goes haywire and we have to cancel credit cards and the sort. Why is it we don't recognize this or we don't we aren't hip to it fast enough?
I think we've been carrying on since the beginning of the internet 25-ish years ago, mm-hmm. and beginning of social media 10 to 13, 14 years ago. We were just so excited about the technology and the opportunity and the connections that we didn't really think through the implications as a society. And as social media in particular, I think of social media as a gangly teenager right now. We're learning how to use it, and it's learning how to use us. And there's a maturity that I think is going to evolve as people become aware of things like their digital footprint, the amount of information they're sharing, how that information is being used. And it's often being used for good. I want to emphasize that I don't think it's a terrible thing to have a digital footprint. I think it's a great way to make your life more efficient, stress-free, all of that. The trouble comes when there's too much going on. Social media is a great example because many people jump onto various accounts because they think they should be there. But how often do they use them? Some people have Twitter accounts that have gone dormant. Some people have Facebook accounts that they use every day. Mm-hmm. There's this spectrum of use, and I would advocate if you're not using it and it's not serving you and you don't have reason to use it occasionally, then maybe it's time to close that account.
And in your particular experience, I mean, are you able to do things like that? Because, I mean, there's an incredible amount of pressure, professionally, personally, family, friends, to be on these different platforms. Are you able to, say, monitor your use of either and say, okay, I don't need this?
To some extent, yes.
Yeah.
And in other cases, I've had to be very careful about, why am I there? LinkedIn is a great example. I know that there are many business professionals who get a great deal of value out of LinkedIn.
Yeah.
But for me, LinkedIn is most often about somebody soliciting me to purchase something.
Mm.
So I tend to resist using LinkedIn beyond its what I would call a Rolodex, an address book.
Mm-hmm.
It's a way to connect with people, a way to be able to reach them, know if they've changed offices, then their current contact information is there. But typically I move the conversation off of LinkedIn and into email or phone call or, goodness gracious, maybe even meeting in person and having a coffee date.
What's that? you realize after reading your book, Declutter Your Data, just how our lives have changed, and not just in the last 25 years, but even in the last couple of years with various innovations, various technologies. I didn't really start using a tablet until about two, three years ago. And now it's something, I carry around. And, I thought when I got it, because I didn't really buy it, it was a gift. I thought, well, I'll just use it to use the internet, Twitter, Facebook. But I wouldn't use it for email. And that's something that you recommend in the book, that certain devices do certain things, right?
Yes, I recommend developing a dedicated devices strategy. Partly it's about efficiency, and partly it's about cueing your mind when you go to that device at the kind of activity that's about to come. So for me, a laptop is as a work tool. It's something I use for writing. I do email on it. If I'm approving artwork for an advertising campaign or something, it's easier on the bigger screen rather than on a mobile phone. Conversely, when I approach my tablet, it's about fun. It's where I watch Netflix. It's where I watch things on iTunes. It's where I read my magazines that are in my Texture subscription. It's where I read the cartoons that I subscribe to on my comics. And it's really an entertainment tool 90% of the time.
Mm.
And I say 90% of the time because I'm preparing to leave for Toronto the day after we have this conversation. And I do think that sometimes tablets can be a useful substitute when you're on the road, so you don't have to carry the laptop with you.
Yeah, or books or yeah, a bunch of magazines, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. You know, there's weight restrictions and carry-on baggage restrictions, right, and baggage fees. So there has to be some flexibility. But at the same time, whereas the way I use a device might be quite different from the way you do or some other individual does, any of the listeners hearing our conversation, everyone has a different approach. One of the most powerful things that people can do as an experiment is take the email app off your mobile phone.
Right.
Even just for a couple of days. See how that feels. For most people, it's very unnerving at first because they can't check their messages. But by only doing email when you have time to do email, you're actually more efficient. So rather than reading it twice, because you read it once on your mobile and then you think, oh, yeah, I better answer that next time I'm on my computer because the file I need to attach is on the computer, it can be very freeing. Now, deleting the email app stresses many people out.
Right.
So
yeah.
If someone's having conniptions listening right now, they could try something lower key. Maybe, you know, take off the social media apps.
Mm. Yeah, like notifications, right? That's another thing that you would advise in the book, that even though we might have Twitter, Facebook on our phones or whatever device it is, turning off notifications might be, well, it's obviously less distracting, right?
Exactly. Turning off notifications is less distracting for you. It's also less distracting for the people around you.
Mm.
I get super frustrated if I'm sitting in a coffee shop working, and I'm sure this is a universal experience where the person next to you, their phone is wiggling and buzzing so much you can't concentrate. There's good research that talks about how we get our focus in on a particular task. And every time a notification flashes in front of us or bings or bongs or buzzes or wiggles, you know, there's different ways it can come in, it draws our focus away from the task at hand. And we're moving away from I'm really fighting against this, but there is a sort of trend to moving away from long-form reading, reading books, reading long articles, reading research, things that are in-depth that really require focus, to reading in little bits and bytes, to, if you will, snippet information, headlines only, first paragraphs only, you know, short paragraphs with lots of pictures, which can be informative and interesting, but I think we lose a lot of depth of data that's available on a given topic. And so I'm hopeful that even just simply by turning off notifications, that when someone is into a task, that they can continue with it, both professionally, work-wise, and socially, having a visit with friends, going to the movies. Maybe you're an artist, an amateur artist who likes to play with watercolors. Once you're in that mode, allow yourself to enjoy that time. And then at an appropriate moment, return to your device of choice and check for messages on Facebook or email or anywhere else.
Yeah. The other thing that you suggest in the book that I think worried me a little bit more, but you'll tell me if it's worked in your experience and with others that you know, is taking vacations from everything, from digital devices. I use BlackBerry. I've used that for years now. And so the last BlackBerry had just died. And so for about a week and a half until the phone company sent me a new one, I was without a phone. And, you know, one does get antsy when one doesn't have their phone with them. And, you know, you're worried that no one will be able to get a hold of you and stuff like that. You know, terribly irrational things. Yet I found after a week and a half, I didn't miss it as much as I thought I would.
Mm-hmm.
Did you find that that's the case, that we need to take these vacations from the stuff around us?
I think the vacations are really important, and I think they can be variable in length. Although you can pay and go on a grand holiday at an unplugged retreat where there is no signal and no devices, whether that's backwoods camping or a fancy retreat and spa hotel kind of setup. But what I would hope people would do more than anything is those big luxury excursions are expensive and outside the realm of accessibility for most of us. Instead, a digital vacation might just be deciding not to use the phone on Sunday mornings.
Mm.
Make that family time, or Friday evenings, or whatever. or even getting in the habit of not making it the first thing that you do in the morning. So many people are keeping the phone beside the bed, and they've hardly opened their eyes. They maybe not even put their glasses on, and they're looking at their phone and trying to discern what's happened that they've missed, this fear of missing out phenomenon. But I think that if we take some time away, we get accustomed to that, and it frees up other opportunities. It reduces the amount of stress we're experiencing by that constant need to check. It's allowing us to have thoughts, you know, bigger, deeper, more majestic thoughts, perhaps, or maybe more mundane thoughts when you suddenly remember all the groceries you haven't purchased.
Yeah.
That's the digital vacation idea. You know, start small. Now, some people find it very hard to be away, or if even starting small is overwhelming, perhaps start with just keeping it available and telling yourself, okay, I'm only going to actually answer the phone if it's the kids' school.
Hmm.
That's a common thing, you know, wanting to be accessible in an emergency.
Yeah.
But ignoring everything else for that hour. There's lots of different ways to interpret a digital vacation, and I talk about some of them in the book. And I hope to continue having that conversation as I hear about people's experiences through Twitter and Instagram and Facebook and email.
Yeah.
It's interesting. As I do this work, it's a constant case study in progress.
Yeah.
I'm attending a conference in a couple of days. I've just come from the Galliano Literary Festival, talking with people about how they're using technology and data with very different audiences at each event that I go to. Is part of this ongoing research, and I hopefully will continue to be able to share best advice moving forward. I stand by everything that's in the book, of course, but I think there's more to come as we all navigate through this digital clutter.
Yeah, and so one of the things that I think a lot of us haven't thought about, and you talk about this in the book, is the digital estate planning. A lot of us don't want to think about death. But it's something that we need to think about death because it's inevitable for all of us. And yet, just imagine if one ceased to live today, just what clutter is left behind and how to manage that. You talk about that in the book, right?
I do, yep. The inspiration for that actually came from my mom's time in hospice, where we spent very little time doing anything technological. We spent all of our time visiting, and after she passed, I realized that I didn't have the password to get into her laptop.
Mm.
I still have the laptop and was able and can use it on a different user ID, but I don't know what's behind it. It's been 4 years since she passed away, but I'm holding out hope that somewhere in one of her notebooks or journals that I'll stumble across the password in the margin and be able to get into her information.
Yeah.
But our information when we die is even more so than what's on our local computer. About our social media accounts. Facebook allows you to establish a legacy account. There are other tools that are maybe not quite as robust, but I think they will become increasingly so for LinkedIn, Twitter, other social media. What about your digital money? Do you have a Square or Shopify account for your business? Do you have a PayPal account? So many of us do because it's a convenient transaction. But if your executor doesn't know that you have that account, and they can't get in, which is a possibility, without the appropriate login and password, there may be virtual money sitting there that should be real money that goes to your heirs in whatever way that you've outlined in your estate. So digital estate planning is a huge topic. These are just a few of the little snippets. We could also talk about digital rights, like who owns your photographs?
Yeah.
Where do they go? We could talk about what you want your information to say to your great-great-grandchildren when they're doing genealogical research.
Mm.
There's so many elements of it, and I actually think I may have to unpack digital estate planning into a bigger project in the near future.
Yeah, there's a lot in this book that's terribly useful. It's nice talking again, Angela. You've done a great service with this book. I hope a lot of people pick it up.
I appreciate having that chance to talk with you, Joseph. Thanks so much for having me on again.
AngelaCrocker.com is the website for more. The book is called Declutter Your Data, Take Charge of Your Data, and Organize Your Digital Life. It's from Self Counsel Press. Angela Crocker, its author, joined me on the line from Port Moody, British Columbia, in Vancouver. I'm Joseph Planta.